Welcome to the Outthinkers Podcast. Plug into fascinating minds and breakthrough ideas that are transforming industries and the world. I'm your host, Kyan Krippendorf, founder of Outthinker Networks, a global think tank comprised of corporate strategists, innovators, and entrepreneurs that are shaping the future of business. If this describes you, join us at outthinker.com. Now, let's dive into this week's episode.
A lot of the failures that we look around and see in our world are, technically speaking, preventable. And many of them could have been prevented had people felt psychologically safe enough to speak up with a, just a small concern or a weak signal, and the unfolding of events could have gone differently. So that part is important. Then the other part of failing well is the willingness to experiment in new territory, to innovate, right? To discover something new, to make progress in new territory. That too is utterly dependent on psychological safety.
That was Amy Edmondson, the Novartis Professor of Leadership and Management at Harvard Business School, renowned for her research over the last 20 years on psychological safety and teaming. Her award-winning work has appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, Psychology Today, Fast Company, Harvard Business Review, and more, named by Thinkers 50 in 2021 as the number one management thinker in the world. Amy's TED Talk, How to Turn a Group of Strangers into a Team, has been viewed over 3 million times. She's the author of The Fearless Organization, Teaming, and most recently, what we get into here, primarily The Right Kind of Wrong. I've been following and sharing Amy's work for years now, and I've gotten to meet her a couple times. She even wrote a generous endorsement for my book, Driving Innovation from Within. In this episode, we dive into the complex territory of navigating risk and failure in the midst of our ever uncertain world. In this conversation, Amy shares what psychological safety is and what it is not, with the central idea being grounded in allowing people the space to experiment and fail. The three types of failure and key characteristics to evaluate what type of failure you might be confronted with. Five questions you can ask to evaluate whether a potentially high-risk failure you're about to take is, as she calls it, an intelligent failure. When you do that, you can avoid hindering your team's pursuit of new ideas while also avoid taking on too much of the wrong kind of risk, which is central to building an innovative organization. Ladies and gentlemen, Amy Edmondson.
Amy, thank you so much for being here with us. It's great to finally get you on the podcast. I want to open up with two questions I ask all my guests. The first one, just for us to get to know you a little bit personally, could you complete this sentence for me? If you really know me, you know that.
You know that the last thing I ever expected to be was a business school professor.
Really? What did you expect to be?
Well, I didn't know really for sure, but I suppose I toyed between just a working engineer and a math teacher.
Huh. And so you studied engineering?
I did study engineering. I studied engineering in college, and then I had the great good fortune to go off and work for my hero. And the best thing I can say about that was that he was still my hero 3 years later. I went to work for Buckminster Fuller, who was just an American visionary, innovative thinker par excellence, and a generous and joyful octogenarian at the time I knew him.
Amazing. Wow. So when I could ask beyond that, but we have very limited time with you. Second question I ask all my guests, because this is a podcast about strategy. What, and I'll tell you, I ask this question, I get a different answer every time. So anything you say is right. What's your definition of strategy?
Making choices, making difficult choices. My definition of strategy is the choices of what we decide not to do.
Got it. Yes, that makes a lot of sense. Now, I really want to spend the time talking about your new book. However, I'd be remiss not to ask you to at least address what psychological safety is, although I know most of our listeners probably already know, but let's hear it from you.
I think it's worth clarifying because there's still a lot of people out there that think psychological safety is either being nice or a state of comfort, right? And in fact, oddly, well, it's certainly not about being mean, but I would argue that psychological safety is oddly a state of being uncomfortable because it's a state of permission for candor. And it's, you know, it's a belief that hard as this might be, I have a kind of permission and obligation to do my best and tell the truth and speak up and ask a question and admit a mistake and all the rest. So shorthand, it's a learning environment.
Got it. And you have in the book a beautiful 2x2 graphic. I don't know if you remember it, but
of course.
I think it's like, you know, high stakes, low stakes, high psychological safety, low psychological safety. Could you just unpack that for us?
Yeah, actually, it's high standards, low standards. We've all worked in environments where, you can get away with a lot, or ones where the rigor is higher than in others. So there's, if you have the horizontal dimension as high and low performance standards, and the vertical dimension is high and low psychological safety, then the lower left-hand quadrant is kind of apathy. It's quit and stay. Not much going on here. Not much learning, not much joy. The upper left is what I call the comfort zone, where there is psychological safety. I really believe I can speak up. I can be myself. I feel quite comfortable with my colleagues and, you know, am pretty sure that what I have to say will be of interest to them. And I'm not working very hard. I'm not holding myself or my colleagues to the highest possible standards. The lower right is what I call the anxiety zone. And it's really more accurate to call it the interpersonal anxiety zone. That's where I'm committed to and understand the high standards around here. And it feels like an impossibility at times to say what I really think, to offer a dissenting view, to ask for help, to admit a mistake. That's not safe. Upper right, well, that's the high performance zone. And I would also argue nowadays that's a zone where we feel better about ourselves. We feel we're being put to good use. And we, more often than not, are really engaged in a kind of a great collaborative journey with people we respect and trust.
Got it. Maybe you could give us an example. I think when I was at McKinsey, they have this term, the obligation to dissent. So there's like a concept of permission.
Right.
And then you also write about Ray Dalio and kind of culture he's built, which is, it seems to me,
it's an extreme. So Dalio extreme. And the Bridgewater, and I do have that in my book. I have a case on it in my book.
Yes.
And I teach a case in my course on Bridgewater, my book, Fearless Organization. I love including that case because it's an extreme version of radical candor. And I'm a big fan of Kim Scott and the book Radical Candor, but it's an extreme version where we really have signed up not just to be candid about our thoughts about the project or our need for help or all the rest, but, you know, in work relevant terms, but they add the kind of personal dimension too, almost the personal growth dimension. And so we have a kind of obligation and permission to give each other very personal feedback in very direct ways. Now, why I love it is not that I necessarily would want to work there myself, but that I believe it's okay to have that choice because people do get to opt in. I mean, nobody is forced to work at Bridgewater. And so those who are opting in and staying in have decided they like this way of working. They like knowing that no one's talking behind their back because they're talking right to them. Right? So it's not for everyone. It doesn't have to be for everyone. Whereas I would argue that kind of the less extreme version where everybody does believe that they have permission to speak up about any and all work-relevant content is good for everybody. I cannot think of a work environment or a company environment where that wouldn't help excellence.
Got it. Yeah. I know many people who have attempted to work there and didn't last very long, but some people can thrive
some
in it.
Do. Yeah. So it's okay. Because again, it's not a, you know, it's nobody's handcuffed to that job.
Yes. Great. Got it. So now I want to switch to the right kind of wrong. But first, I want to understand, I think I know, but maybe you could explain what is the logical link between psychological safety and what you write in The Right Kind of Wrong?
That's funny because I've always been interested in learning organizations, and learning and failure and error are components of learning, no matter how you slice it. And so in a way, I was thinking about failure and mistakes before I was ever thinking about psychological safety. But the logical link in my mind is pretty clear. If we are to be in environments where people feel able to speak up about mistakes or deviations that could lead to failures, that's psychological safety, right? So if you want excellence, so there's two aspects of failing well, right? One aspect is preventing as many as possible preventable failures. Now, I know that sounds almost circular, but it's, you know, a lot of the failures that we look around and see in our world are technically speaking preventable. And many of them could have been prevented had people felt psychologically safe enough to speak up with a, you know, just a small concern or a weak signal. And, you know, the rest, the unfolding of events could have gone differently. So that part is important. Then the other part of failing well is the willingness to experiment in new territory, to innovate, right? To discover something new, to make progress in new territory. That too is utterly dependent on psychological safety, because without psychological safety, you've got people maybe trying to do very good work, but truly doing it in a risk-averse way. So the only experiments, so-called experiments, they're willing to engage in are the ones that they know will succeed, which of course is not an experiment.
So you lay out three types of failure. I was wondering if you could tell the single failure, complex failure, intelligent failure, if I'm remembering that correctly.
Basic, but that's okay. You know, basic, okay. Complex, and intelligent. They're not, it's not like a scale of, you know, from better to worse. Because so basic failures are simple. Basic failures are caused by a single force, usually human error. Right? So basic failures are undesired results in known territory, you know, caused by a deviation from the knowledge that we could have otherwise used. So they aren't all small, right? If I forget to charge my cell phone, I miss an important meeting, that's a basic failure, but probably not a very big deal. If I, you know, if I'm the pilot running through the pre-flight checklist and I miss a step just by mistake and it ends up leading to a crash, that's still a basic failure, but it's a huge and consequential basic failure. So the distinctions between the three are not at all based on size. They're based on type. Complex failures are multi-causal. They are the kinds of failures that happen when a handful of factors line up in just the wrong way. And generally, any one of the factors on its own would not have caused the failure. So, you know, the small deviations from best practice, the not really paying attention, and most of the time we get away with it, but then, you know, or, you know, a supply chain breakdown in another part of the world ends up leading to problems or failures in your factory and an inability to deliver what you promised your customer. That's a complex failure. A handful of things had to go slightly wrong for that to happen. And an intelligent failure is the only kind of good kind. And also, interestingly, the only theoretically non-preventable kind, because intelligent failures take place in new territory, where we don't yet have a playbook, in pursuit of a goal, where we've taken the time to think through what we're going to risk here, right? We've got a hypothesis, and they are no bigger than they have to be to get the new knowledge, right? So it could be just a small experiment in a lab. It could be a pilot project with customers. Could be a clinical trial of a new med. But however you slice, you don't want it to be larger than necessary for it to be intelligent.
Great. Yeah, and just for the listeners who haven't read the book yet, you are laying out like a very specific five aspects of,
right,
of an intelligent failure. So it takes place in new territory. It's opportunity driven. It's informed by prior knowledge. It's as small as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But I also hear it's not only as small as possible, it's also smaller than your ability to absorb.
That's right. Like, you don't invest more money than you can afford to lose, because you might lose it, right? You're aware of that going in. You're aware of the uncertainty and the risk going in. So you manage risk. And of course, the fifth one is, yeah, take the time to learn from it, because otherwise you haven't used your investment very well.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. So a lot of what you write about in sort of podcast lesson two talk about the individual kind of personal experience, the shame and the like. I want to talk more kind of about the systematic approach. But there, you also talk about this unequal license to fail. My wife is a woman and a woman of color, and she told me, like, she going through college and law school and her law firm, she just did not have the freedom to fail as, or she didn't feel she did as much as others did.
And I think she's right. And of course, my aspiration and yours too is to make the playing field more level, where all of us have equal opportunities to fail. But the fact is, the reality is today that if you are underrepresented in some population, let's say senior executives or scientists, you know, or business school professors, whether by your race, your gender, your sexual orientation, your nationality, there aren't other people like you, you know that you're at risk of spoiling it for others, right? So you feel more anxious about failing because you believe, and not entirely erroneously, that your failure may be attributed to your identity group. And so that's not right. Like, that's a fault in our cognition, but it's a fault we haven't managed to wipe out yet.
Yes, right, because we're representing our identity group.
Right, right, in a way that, let's just say, you know, a white male executive, nobody thinks, well, his failure was because he was a white man, and those guys just never amount to much, right? Nobody, you know, that's nonsense, right? So that's what the aspiration is, to say, you know, that your wife, you know, fails at something and no one even thinks twice about the group that she's from or represents, right? They just think, oh, well, you know, bad choice because of the school she went to, or, you know, whatever, like something that isn't related to demographics.
Got it. Okay, great. So let's just imagine a scenario here. There is a head of strategy. They're sitting in a review with leadership. We're making resource allocation decisions, priorities for the next quarter, the next year. And say there's someone, maybe the head of a business unit or a brand, and they offer a new idea. Maybe it's a new channel or a new product feature. I mean, you already laid out kind of how you can recognize if pursuing that is an intelligent risk. But let's say that the way they frame their next action would not constitute a potentially intelligent failure. How would that person respond?
Well, that's a great question. So, I mean, I think, first of all, you know, for that hypothetical, what might be an example of that? It might be, I mean, I think the one that comes to mind, well, the two ones that I see violated most often are sized, you know, where we do a major product launch that, had we just explored a little more closely, we could have found a whole bunch of people in the company who could have told us that will not work, right? Crystal Light back in the day was just the scientists and the bottlers and everybody else could tell you this will have a shelf life of, you know, a day. Like, it just won't work, right? But nonetheless, big splash, big introduction of this sort of cola type clear beverage in a clear bottle failed badly. Okay. So one is just too big, right? And actually, I think I've just said them both in that example, because too big, and we had the knowledge. If we is the company within our walls, we had the knowledge we needed to know this wouldn't work, but we either didn't hear it, didn't listen to it, didn't go look for it. And so we had a preventable failure. And so then now I want to say, okay, how do we make sure never do that again? And it's, how do we, not just that exact thing, but that phenomenon, how do we make sure we use the knowledge we have, you know, that we are well set up to actually leverage, you know, the magnificent knowledge and talent in our midst. And we don't make that error again. And number two, how do we manage the right size risk so that we aren't either destroying value or destroying our reputation or both?
Great. Yeah. So link that, what you were saying, the way you defined it before, we've got these five definitions and you're talking about informed by prior knowledge and as small as possible.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Perfect.
And then make sure we learn from it. If you experience a preventable or a big failure sometime in the future, it's disappointing, and take the time to learn all that you can from it.
Yeah, so I can imagine that you can sort of have this as a checklist and then look for where it doesn't qualify and then look at reshaping. So what would you do at that point if it breaks one of those five definitions? What would you do? I can imagine, but yeah. You would cut down the risk, say, could we do something smaller?
Right, right.
And have you spoken to this other department and checked our knowledge base?
Yeah, so I'd first, you know, I'd ideally, we're able to ask these good questions in advance and prevent the visible or large failure in the first place. And, you know, second best case is we didn't prevent it, but we're going to at least learn everything we can from it. But the five criteria that we've gone through can be used as you said, as a checklist, right? There, we can have a set of questions that we routinely and rigorously ask to for, you know, any sort of risky activity. And by risky, I really mean just, you know, non-certain activity, right? A new project, a new product, a new hire, you know, a tentative new executive hire. Right? We can go through these questions in advance. We don't have to wait until the failure and then go back and see what we missed.
Got it. Yes. And then there's also this dimension of stakes, right? Like high stakes and low stakes. And like, and some companies, you know, they make rocket ships, and if they fail, then that's the consequences are significant. And yet they also have decisions like, could we revisit how we do progress reviews? And there's a tendency to like have the same level of rigor. Could you talk to us about that?
That's a great point. And I think one of the kind of leadership competencies that really matters, you know, in our VUCA, volatile, uncertain, complex, ambiguous world, or in the world of strategy and innovation more broadly, one of the competencies is situation awareness or context awareness. And that is the, not ability, because I think we all have this ability, but the tendency to pause to size up the context. And the two dimensions of context that I think matter most are, what are the stakes, as you said? What are they, higher or lower? Keeping in mind that's always relative. You know, high stakes for you might be slightly lower for me, or vice versa, in terms of certainly. And what goes into stakes? I think human safety is number one. We always want to be very cautious and thoughtful when human safety might be at risk. Financial stakes, they can be higher or lower. And again, that's one that's very much relative. You know, a global corporation has more tolerance to play with money than a single individual in their lives. And thirdly, reputation, right? Well, you know, does our reputation stand to be harmed in an important way by a failure here, right? So we've sort of figured out what are the stakes? And the other dimension is uncertainty. And, you know, in high stakes, but highly certain contexts, let's just apply best practice and get on with it, right? Let's be rigorously careful with using, you know, working with dangerous machinery, for example, or taking 350 passengers from point A to point B in an airplane. We're rigorously vigilant about doing the best work we can. If the, you know, if we're in a, you know, highly uncertain but reasonably low stakes context, like a scientific laboratory or an innovation department, we should be having a lot of fun experimenting thoughtfully, right? Just go for it. And don't, because I think there's a tendency to hold back because of embarrassment or a desire to be right, you know? And so then people get risk averse and they don't play to win, they play not to lose. And then innovation suffers.
Yeah. I mean, you've unpacked so much and I would love to dig into that. I'll encourage people to do that because the desire for perfection, you talk a lot about, and embarrassment and the fear of embarrassment are two important factors, which are more cultural factors. So let's just expand a little bit further now, cultural kind of, because I hear you saying is that an easy answer is say, we'll build rocket ships, so we should always be rigorously diligent about everything, but then you lose the opportunity to innovate in other places that are lower risk or where the payoff of taking risks is higher and we can be managed. So my two-point question, and you work with a lot of companies and kind of adopting and shifting culture. So two questions, what are the key cultural drivers or factors or something that you should look at? And then from one of our members, she has this question for you. I used to work with a senior leader at a prior company who would say, we need to either fast fail or fast scale. And she loves that saying. Her question is, how do you shift a corporate culture of making failures okay and turn them into learnings as fast as possible? And is there a way to do this quickly?
Well, yes. I think the answer is yes, right? Without knowing exactly what quickly means. But so I love that the term and the pairing fast fail, fast scale reminds me of the old S curve. You know, or of any, you know, the sort of S-curve in entrepreneurship where, you know, any new enterprise, maybe new project as well, but has its kind of wandering around stage where, we're experimenting like crazy, trying to come up with the scalable, replicable, valuable product or service that then can scale. So, and that's often I think there's two places where companies are very vulnerable to failing, you know, and one is not making that transition from phase one to phase two, the transition from, you know, just mucking about till we find something that works to scaling it up to a size where we can actually make profitable growth happen. And oftentimes that shift, I mean, that breakdown that can happen there is a failure to shift the culture, right? That we can't quite let go of our crazy fun informality and buckle down and adopt the rigor of adherence to the standards and processes that we've created to allow us to scale. The other place that companies are vulnerable is when this particular wonderful, profitable, scaling operation comes to an end, as they all do. Either the world changes, you know, tastes change, new competition comes in and has something better. And so we now, again, we must pivot. We must go back to or forward to a new period, a different kind of period of experimenting to find a new area of value creation that we then will ultimately be able to scale as well. And so both of those are mindset shifts. Now, how do you make that shift? Whichever shift it might be, I think leadership, which is the art of influencing others in desired ways, is needed. And recently I started thinking about this as the three M's. It's not quite perfect, but it's basically messaging, modeling, and mentoring. You know, messaging is the language you use, the messaging that you put forth, and it really matters, right? We are shifting to a period of efficient, high quality production, right? And this is going to be a different way of being, and different things will be valued. I mean, you say the words that are true and helpful so that people can begin to see the world in a new way and realize it's going to call for new behaviors. You're modeling those new behaviors. You are showing up in a way that sort of shows, if you used to be showing up as just, hey, an idea a minute, now you're showing up with a new respect for the discipline of repetition and accuracy, you know, whatever it is, right? Whatever shift you're trying to make. Usually it's the other way around, by the way, or at least in many of the companies that I've studied, it's like they're trying to get more creative, more innovative. And mentoring is really my M word for coaching, right? For the provision of one-on-one or customized feedback for people who need to alter their behaviors in ways that will help build this new culture. And I say fast because I think you do that well and you do it consistently and you just keep showing up. People are smart. They'll get the message. They'll begin to, you know, culture has been defined as sort of what's valued around here. And we all want to do the what's valued around here as long as we're aware of it and learn quickly that it doesn't get punished.
Got it. I love it. Again, I got 15 more questions and probably just time for one more. Let me just try one with you that I haven't seen you written about, but I have a feeling that you've thought about it because you have done a lot of research and written a lot on teaming. We had one of our guests, Russ Newman, he was talking about AI as a potentially really useful coach for helping us think through the natural human biases we have. And a lot of these things that lead us away from intelligent failure are recency bias and filtering and things like that. Have you thought about like how AI interacting with humans and teams could...
I have, but I have to admit, I haven't thought deeply enough about it. And I don't feel expert enough to think deeply enough. But it does seem, I mean, one of the areas of promise is just as you were describing is where if we can get help from that little coach, you know, that little bot coach in overcoming our human cognitive failings, which are very much, you know, very spontaneous, you know, recency, confirmation bias, all of that. If there's some little reminder, because I always tell people, you know, I mean, for years I've said, you know, remind yourself, you don't have the whole picture. But who, you know, who's capable of in the moment, under stress, seeing things clearly, believing that it's time to pause and say, I wonder what I'm missing? And that's the question I truly want everyone to be asking. Well, maybe my little AI friend could remind me to ask, you know, what am I missing? Or maybe even point out some of the things that I am clearly missing with my, you know, confirmation bias or tunnel vision or particular area of expertise, or on and on it goes.
Yeah, it reminds me of you writing about stop, challenge, choose is what I'm sort of hearing.
Yes, indeed. And here's, yes, so maybe our little friend could stop, challenge, choose for us, or, you know, remind us to stop, would prompt some of the questions that I have in the, you know, in the table of, you know, here's what you do when you pause. Here's what you do to challenge your automatic thinking and make it better. And here's what you do when you choose something that's in your best interest could be our good friend for that.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being here. What I love about your work is there's a tendency in this VUCA world, as you say, to either contract or just fly out blindly, and you give us some structure to create a middle path or a third path. How can people continue to learn from you and connect with you?
Well, thank you for that. By the way, I love that description of that middle path. It's kind of a more nuanced, thoughtful path, and I hope an actionable one. And thank you so much for having me on the show. It's been a true delight to talk to you. I think the shortest answer is amycedmondson.com has books, articles, you know, links to other things that might be of interest.
Lovely. Well, thank you for the work that you do and for spending some time to unpack some of it here with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you to our guests. Thank you to our executive producer, Karina Reyes, our editor, Zach Ness, and the rest of the team. If you like what you heard, please follow, download, and subscribe. I'm your host, Kyan Krippendorf. Thank you for listening. We'll catch you soon with another episode of Outthinkers.